Okay, well, I think this is going to be more on the vein of a few on review talk. There will be very few new results, but I think there is some interest in comparing problems that you guys have been interested in with problems that we have been working on for the past 20 years, perhaps, more than 10. At least in my case, it's less than 10, but the field as such is older than that. And there are people here in this room, particularly Tony, who have made a lot of contributions to the subject, and he will find some of my transparencies rather familiar for that reason. Okay, so let me... I'm going to assume that most of you guys probably, I'm sure, have heard of the quantum Hall effect, but know little about it, so I'm not going to assume that you are experts on that. And I want to contrast two approaches to that problem, one of which is similar to what is being done nowadays, my understanding of what is being done nowadays in the context of non-commutative field theories in particular, which bears a lot of analogies with some one of the approaches of the quantum Hall effect. There is an alternative approach that in some sense has been more useful from the point of view of making analytic predictions, that doesn't seem to have materialized in the context of string theory. I would call that the hydrodynamic approach, which Tony was one of the major proponents in the context of the quantum Hall effect. And I'd like to say, to contrast these two approaches for the quantum Hall effect, maybe you will find it of some use. Since I don't know what the audience will be, in other words, how many of the other guys were going to come as well, I prepared a very short motivation to non-commutative ideas in the context of string theory at a very elementary level, and since most of you know that, probably would skip it. Okay, but I want to fix some ideas in any case. So there is a, first of all, let me begin with the following. There is a long history of conceptual connections between quantum Hall physics and ideas of string theory. And in the past 10 years, perhaps the most interesting and successful connection comes from the fact that the systems or the states that display what is known as the fractional quantum Hall effect are incompressible states, and as such it means that all the excitations in the middle of the system cost a lot of energy, and the only low line excitations actually live at the boundary of the system. And people found an interesting one-to-one correspondence between the excitations in the bulk and the excitations in the edge. That correspondence, which nowadays I believe is also called duality among many other things, is familiar from the kind of things that you guys do in ADS and so forth. This is sort of a more elementary example and is similar to what people did, in particular Witten did a long time ago, in the context of the Chan-Simons theory, which actually plays a central role in the effective theories of the quantum Hall effect. So it's not surprising that this analogy comes up. Okay, so in that context, for instance, many of the things that we know about the theory of the edge states of the quantum Hall effect, we borrowed a lot from conformal field theory in particular. Okay, so there are many of those ideas that showed up quite early in that theory. Now there has been some renewed connections in the context of this problem of the one-to-one correspondences. And what I want to insist is that in some sense, this is actually in some sense the simplest holographic theory we know of, okay, from this point of view. Now, quantum Hall systems, by definition, live on a non-commutative plane. Namely, these are particles which are charged. They live in a plane, they sit on a plane, and there is a huge magnetic field perpendicular to the plane. And therefore, it's not surprising that some of the same ideas showed up. Now, for us to work in what I'm going to call the projection to the lowest lambda level, which looks very much like what you guys do, is what we would like to do, but turns out to be very difficult to live with that. Okay? Now, I want to have some discussion here on what people have done and how we have made progress in some directions. And for the most part, I must say, working in the lowest lambda level has not been the way in which people have really made progress, even though that's what we would like to do. And I will comment on what the problems are in particular. Okay, so let me skip. This was the transparency that I had in case there were people from the other. Well, there's at least one person, so I will go quickly over this, too. So, as you know, we have particles in magnetic fields in the context of quantum Hall effect. You guys will call these D0 brains attached to D2 brains. So, and I think some people at Stanford are thinking of trying to solve problems in quantum Hall physics by using that language. I'm not sure if that's per se useful, unless you have some great ideas. The change of language is not always illuminating. In this case, I'm not sure if it is. So the simplest example is a string on a two torus. So there are two fields, therefore, and you may have, they may be on a cylinder or maybe on an open boundary. And imagine that, so you're going to have this anti-symmetric matrix here for the people from the other workshop or from the high temperature, high TC workshop. These things are usually called the Lattinger parameters, so they form a matrix, okay, in that language. And there is always a possibility to have a term that breaks the universal symmetry. This is written Euclidean space, it's a factor of I, and you have a matrix, an object like that, which has some quantity, maybe called the theta angle, and you will see has an analogy with magnetic flux. This is this anti-symmetric tensor field that you guys talk about. Now this term is a total derivative, in fact it's a Pontryagin index, so it's an instant term number counting term, and therefore if you work on a cylinder, say if you have an open string with two boundaries, this guy gets essentially only a contribution at the boundaries, and the contribution at the boundaries looks like x1 times the time derivative of x2 minus the derivative of x1 times x2. So in other words, the field at the boundary looks like a particle in a magnetic field on its own. So this looks like the effective action, if you want, of a massless particle in an external magnetic field, phi. So in fact, because there are two endpoints, in reality, you have to be careful with the orientation. There are two terms here, one for the particle here, the other for the other endpoint there, and therefore this string has the structure of a dipole because of that. Now, I want to mention this because there are problems in the context of the quantum Hall effect. In fact, most of the open problems involve situations where we have dipoles, and therefore I wanted to mention that issue. Okay. So the effective action, therefore, looks like a Feldspan-Tice theory where you have the action of a point particle moving in a magnetic field. In this case, there will be two of them with equal and opposite charge. Okay? So either they are massless, as in the case of a relativistic theory, or in the lowest, if you actually project into the lowest lambda level, in the non-relativistic case, it is as if it were massless. So if you crank up the magnetic field to infinity, it has the same effect. So this already tells you, if you read off the commutation relations from here, that you have precisely the magnetic, the non-commutative plane, and it's this simply the magnetic algebra that you're going to get from here. Now in the context of the Landau theory of particles in magnetic fields that goes back to 1927, these things are usually called guiding center coordinates, okay, that satisfy these commutation relations. Okay, so let me compare a little bit the story about Landau levels. This is going to be a little boring, but it's still too important to set the notation. For non-relativistic problems of the type that we have to deal with in condensed matter physics, what one has is the conventional non-relativistic Landau levels. Each one of these levels has a degeneracy which is equal to the number of flat quanta, and typically what we would like to do is to work in the manifold of the degenerate states that live down here. And therefore to deal with interactions and all the interesting physics by projecting out, if possible, all these higher order lambda levels. That, of course, is achieved often, at least formally, by sending the magnetic field to infinity. At the level of a single particle problem, it's the same as sending the mass to zero. When you put interactions, these two things not only coincide, they don't always coincide. Now in the relativistic case, of course, the situation is a little different. You have a manifold of zero modes, if you have direct particles in the magnetic field, massive particles. You have zero modes, which have exactly the same degeneracy. And then you have particles and antiparticles that change the difference. Now in the problems that we are usually interested in, we want to think of a situation where there is some finite number of particles, in particular some macroscopic number of particles occupying some finite fraction of these states. Okay, and we call that measure of the density, the filling fraction, and that's the ratio of the number of particles divided by the number of flux quanta. So in this sense, we are not keeping, if you want, particle hole symmetry or charge conjugation invariants intact, but there are cases in particular where this guy, these states here are half-filled, where you essentially find an effective charge conjugation symmetry in the problem, and that is exactly the problem, the situation where some of these dipoles show up, is in that case. Some of the situations, the cases where the physics of the dipoles show up precisely where you are close to half-filling. Okay, so at this state, this label is half-filled. So most of the open problems nowadays in the context of the physics of the quantum Hall effect have to do with working with states which are nearly half-filled. I will explain why that's problematic later on. Now, at the level of these sort of non-interacting pictures, one thing that is often useful to think about, and in particular in the experiments, that's really what happens, what you have is essentially a fluid of electrons that are sitting over here, and there is some electric field that is applied to keep the electrons from spilling out of the system. So you put an external electric field pointing in, and you have the magnetic field pointing up, if you want. And it's easy to show, for instance, if this obvious, it's obvious that this is the case, in particular if the electric field is rotational invariant, so if it is radial, that the lambda levels essentially begin to bend up. This is a picture that was proposed by Halperin a long time ago. And so instead of having a strict degeneracy, the states with higher angular momentum acquire higher and higher energy, and at some point you cross the Fermi energy and you decide that you're going to fill up these states and you're going to leave those states empty. So the only low energy excitations that you have are not the guys which live here. They, you need to pay a great deal of energy. You need to go, say, to the next lambda level, for example, as in this example here. The low energy excitations actually live here close to the Fermi energy, and these are states with very high angular momentum. And because of the properties of the wave functions in the lowest lambda level, there is a connection between the maximum value of the amplitude of the wave function and the angular momentum goes like the square root of n. Therefore, the states with largest angular momentum, they are effective radials. They look like orbits in that sense. They look like classical orbits almost. And they actually are further out. And therefore, in a sense, what you are beginning to describe are the fluctuations of the states that live close to the boundary of the system. So in fact, this is what defines the physical boundary. It's this electric field that has essentially turn a bunch of states that were otherwise degenerate, have lifted the degeneracy here. In fact, the slope here is determined among other things by the electric field. For instance, in a non-interacting problem, the velocity of these excitations is nothing but the velocity of electrons in cross electric and magnetic fields. It's a very simple calculation. Okay? So in this particular case, and I want to mention this because I can...
The energy balls are, strictly speaking...
Boundary, correct. And they are chiral. Okay, so they move only in one direction, and there is no returning wave, so to speak. And in this particular case, if they are non-interacting, they are chiral charged fermions, okay?
What if you put the system on the torus?
If you put the system on the torus, there is no edge. And therefore, the only thing you get is the physics of the bulk. And you have a bunch of excitations. There's a gap. All the excitations are gapped. And there is nothing. There are no low energy excitations left. So in fact, that theory, if you want, if you have a system on actual, in a physical torus, it's actually a topological field theory in a sense. But I'm going to come back to that later to show what the effective action looks like. Right. Well, there are modes which are sort of topological, the things associated with the motion of the center of mass around the
sphere. So
if you take the sphere, it turns out that there is a unique ground state, and if you have a more complicated object, it turns out that there is a degeneracy of the ground state determined by the number of handles of the surface mass. So it's a topological fluid in that sense. And the degeneracy depends on that, and that's something that Wang, for instance, introduced the number of years of dimension. So, in fact, that's one of the that topological degeneracy is one of the characterizing features of these fluids. Now, so there are two ways to access the physics of the of these topological fluids. One will be by working on closed manifolds, which experimentalists have a hard time coming by, and the other is by investigating the properties of these edge states because of the one-to-one correspondence between the edge and the bulk.
Is there a simple way to explain the origin of the degeneracy in the topological case?
Well, yeah, let me come back to that later. I will write down defective action, and you will see once I write down defective action where that comes from. It comes, in the short answer, it comes from the large gauge transformation. So you have to quantize those things. Okay. So that's a sort of a quick picture of what the one particle theories look like. And, of course, all of these problems always have interactions, and therefore you have to, you cannot deal with that as a non-interacting problem anymore. And what people do, there are two approaches that people have followed. One is by first projecting into the lowest lambda level, because that's actually that's in some sense a relevant manifold of states. Okay? And very quickly, things look like the kind of things that I have seen in the literature of non-commutative field theories in particular. So they look very similar. So let me go over that. In the lowest lambda level in particular, the wave functions are, the single particle states are holomorphic. Forget these integrating factors that always appear, and going from now on, the magnetic length is going to be set to 1, so it will be the shortest scale in the problem anyways. So there is always a fundamental scale, and that's important. So this is very popular and famous Laughlin wave function for special sets of states that have filling factor 1 over m, where m is an odd integer, has to be odd because this object is supposed to be electrons which are fermions, and therefore has to be odd under exchange of any pair of electrons. And in this particular case, that forces m to be an odd integer. Again, there are these factors over here. You notice that this wave function is holomorphic, and therefore it's completely in the lowest lambda level. Okay? But it turns out, Laughlin called it as a joke, this is a variation of wave functions. You can tell there are no variational parameters here. M is an integer that is determined by the filling factor. This is just a determined by the magnetic field, so there is nothing variational. It's just a guess. And it turns out to be an excellent guess. It works, you can change, because precisely of the presence of a huge magnetic field, the pair interaction among the electrons changes the short distance physics. It's important for the energy, but not to the structure of the wave function. It's one of the few examples, in fact the only one I know, where the wave function has some sort of universal properties. Usually wave functions depend on all kinds of crap that you can imagine. It's determined entirely on short distance physics. It's certainly, there's nothing universal about it. Because of the topological character of the fluid, the wave functions are having universal properties. And that's a unique feature of this.
But the exact wave function would have to be modified by something.
There will be some irrelevant corrections. But the point is that the order of the zero, for example, is a robust property of the wave function. So you can add terms here that will give you higher order zeros. But the leading order is going to be that.
I think the zero is instead of
a
zero, you get...
Well, you get your sort of dipoles here and things of that sort. But the leading order at short distances is both a short and long. That's also interesting. You can derive this wave function in two different ways. One is by demanding that as these zeros, the coordinates of the particles come together, you get the vanishing of a certain order. That's determined in some sense by the angular momentum, the relative angular momentum of the states. The other is by constructing an effective low energy theory, in which case you are taking the two coordinates very far apart. So it has this funny feature that to some extent is universal in the two ends.
But then that takes the function completely because it has to be
cooler than this. Yeah, it means that there will be some form factor that you have to have, and at long distances it goes to one, and at short distances it's subdominant relative to that. So, and that's actually what happens.
No,
it's
interesting.
One plus
E.
But it has to be a polynomial.
It has to be a polynomial. Well, it's an infinite polynomial within the thermodynamic limit.
The prime number was expanded.
Right. But the fact is, but the point is that in order to make the argument that you get universality at long distances, you need a thermodynamic limit first. Otherwise, you get none. So you need to take first the radius of the droplet to infinity, and then you ask what is the asymptotic form of the wave function as they are farther apart in the magnetic length, but short compared, say, to the radius of the system. Mm-hmm. And in that regime, it's universal. Okay. If you want, I can show you how it comes about. That's actually one of the peculiar features. I mean, normally you look at the wave functions depending on all kinds of microscopic properties. They have no right of any sort of universality, and here they do. Okay. So the other thing that people showed, and I'm going to come back in the hydrodynamic picture to explain this a little better, there are three features that emerge from the states. One is the quantity that the experimenters measure most easily, which is the conductivity, the Hall conductivity, which comes out to be quantized or fractional, in units of 1 over m of the quantum of conductivity, which is E square of H in two dimensions. Mm-hmm. All excitations are got, and they carry fractional charge and fractional statistics. I'll come back to that in a little while. Now, if you really wanted to write down the theory directly in the lowest Landau level, what you do is you say, well, electrons, how they interact? They interact with a pair interaction, which is a product of two densities. And since you have already projected into the lowest Landau level, there is no kinetic energy. So the only interaction, the only piece of the Hamiltonian is just the potential energy. So it's not kinetic plus potential, it's just potential, okay, due to the projection. That makes perturbation theory rather difficult to do. Okay? So let me write down the density operator, which is formally, at least in first quantization, is a sum of delta functions. But if you are going to project into the lowest Landau level, these coordinates, these axes here, don't connect with each other. Okay? And therefore, the density operators obey a special algebra. The algebra is the algebra that you guys love. It's this non-commutative Boyle bracket, if you want. And this was, in this context, derived by, I think, was Gervin, McDonald, and Platzman about 1984, 85. I forgot exactly when this was done. And because these guys wanted to project, so then what they did was they expanded out in modes and calculated by projecting to the lower Landau level. So if P and Q are the momenta associated with the Fourier transforms for the density, you end up with it. Okay, so so what you want to do is to write down some Hamiltonian like this. We have a pair of fields, in this case densities, and this is what Duncan Haldane has been doing for a good number of years. And then projecting it into the lowest Landau level, where you have to deal with this algebra. Now, this is all very nice, but the problem is it's really difficult to solve this problem, because this algebra...
And the Hamiltonian is that where the...
With the projection.
Where is the projection?
Well, I didn't write it down. All I said is if you simply project these density operators into the lowest Landau level, and you force, therefore,
so
this
algebra... How do you apply the projection? Do you apply it?
On the density operators first. What you do is you write, you just project the states into the lowest Landau level.
Okay.
And that's all you do. You can write it down in terms of creation annihilation operators acting on the states that live in the lowest Landau level. It's some quartic expression that is not particularly writing. But this, the simple way to write it down.
Transitions where you go to some back again.
What you can do is you can calculate corrections to the effective Hamiltonian by, if you want, integrating out over such intermediate processes.
And it's not exact. It's not the same thing.
It gives you corrections to this Hamiltonian.
But which goes zero in the field western.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so it's still exact.
Yeah, that's important, by the way, if you want to calculate things like check the conservation laws for the currents. In fact, to do that properly, you need to do that, otherwise the system is so rigid that you can't really have any dynamics in there. And people have to struggle with that to do that properly. And you can't project first, you have to go through this intermediate step.
Right, for infinite field.
For infinite field, then you project. Yeah, but if you do the infinite field limit first, you get that the special derivative, namely the special divergence of the current is zero, but you really want to have is a continuity equation. So you need some derivative t someplace, okay? And that's hard to do if you project completely. So people had to struggle through that, and various people came up with solutions to that problem.
Is the Laughlin wave function supposed to be in some sense an eigenstate?
Well, there is a particular Hamiltonian of this. If you expand it out in Fourier modes, there is a particular Hamiltonian that essentially, the point is the following, because of the form of the wave function, and because of essentially the Pauli principle, whatever happens with the two particles on top of each other is of little interest. So the delta function contribution of the potential really is invisible. So essentially, if you take something like this, where the potential is something like what would be the Laplacian of a delta function, but projected into the lowest lambda level, it will give you a non-trivial, it gives you a state for which the Laplacian wave function is an eigenstate. In fact, an eigenstate of zero energy. Okay. Now, it's important if you really did scattering theory for point particles in a plane, that is without projection, where you took, say, the Laplacian of the delta function, it was shown longer, I think, by Heisenberg, that the scattering matrix is one. It's only when you get an attractive interaction when you get something interesting. So delta function-like potentials, if you really work with point particles, are sick. In this case, because of the projection to the lower lambda level, because the things get smeared on the scale of the magnetic length, then you do get an interaction and the Laplacian wave function happens to be the eigenstate, the lowest energy eigenstate of all. So it's a rather simple Hamiltonian, but if you want to use one-way interactions, it makes a little difference. So if you calculate the overlap, it's like 99% or something like that. So the energies are a little different, but the states are almost identical.
Okay.
If you want to calculate with a realistic one-way interaction, one over R with the Coulomb interaction. I mean, you're supposed to use the Coulomb interaction, right? And that's, somebody told us that that's what the interaction is supposed to be. If you calculate numerically for a finite system, say with 8 particles or something like that, and you calculate with an effective what then calls pseudo potentials, which are these projected Laplacians of delta functions, you have an exact solution. And if you were to calculate numerically what the answer would be for one over R Coulomb interaction, turns out that the overlap is like 99%. So it's essentially one. Okay. Now, the problem is that it's hard to work with. Essentially, what one is doing is some sort of non-relativistic field theory with these NVL brackets as your commutation relations. And those things are hard to do. So, in fact, there are cases, for instance, in the particular case of mu equals 1 over m and many other fractions like that, where we have some good ideas about what the system looks like. So, for instance, you end up with an energy gap. You can do sort of variational calculations or things of that sort. There you can do perturbation theory about these particular points. But it turns out that if you take the states, if you try to go, for instance, to the center of the lambda level where mu is 1/2, it turns out that the states, the gap of the states collapses there. So we don't have a gap state anymore. And therefore, perturbation theory about something with a gapless spectrum is very dangerous. You end up with infrared divergences. And I will come back to that problem later on. Okay? So in that particular case, then in some sense, it's not entirely clear what are the effects, how something like this will behave. And for instance, people like Haldane and Pasquier and Dan Hailey have tried to make, essentially to reformulate this problem entirely in these places. And for reasons that will become clear with it when I formulate the other approach, which is simple in some ways, but it's complicated in that particular limit. So let me get to that and you will see what the issues
are. You know that for any new except 1/2.
Well, there are a few other cases, 1/4, 1/6, and so on. There are all these 1 over even, are like accumulating points of special hierarchies of fraction Hall states that have progressively smaller gaps. And when you get there, the gap collapses, and you get what people think about it what people call a compressible state. And where that compressible state is
every odd inverse integer is arbitrarily close to.
Well, okay, that's a different story. The question is, in principle, people do these sort of general hierarchies, where essentially it's P over Q, where Q is any other integer. In practice, however, most of the states are never seen. The only state, experimentally, the only states that are actually seen are states that form in this reduced hierarchy. So-called Jain, these are the so-called Jain states. And they look like P over 2P on plus minus 1, where P and N are integers, are positive integers. So these states, if you look here, so if you take P to infinity, they converge to 1 over 2N as you take P to infinity. And these states do not fill up, if you want densely, the plane of possible fractions. They are much fewer than those. It turns out that most of the states that are seen that are fully polarized electron states, they are all in these sequences. And the ones that are not in those sequences usually happen to spin seems to be playing a role, either they are unpolarized or they are partially polarized. So there is some question whether the full hierarchy can, in some sense, is realized or not in physical systems. Otherwise, you have the problem that you mentioned, that of course you can always get up to an arbitrarily close to a state with an even denominator as much as you want. Okay, so it's not a well-defined problem. Okay, so that's an open issue, and different people have different points of view. My personal take is that probably the only states that are realized are this ones for reasons.
What is special about
this? These are the so-called Jain states. It turns out that you can describe, there is a field theory you can derive, from which you can use to derive these states. And it's based on the notion of flux attachment, of mapping essentially fermions to fermions by attaching new number of flux quanta. And it turns out that these are the states that appear naturally in the data.
Starting with one third, I think.
So starting with anything. Yeah. What is hard to do, what you need to do, let me not discuss that issue, it's a separate question. And there are different schools of thought on that. Okay, so the problem is, people have tried to use this for many things. For instance, numerically, this has been the most profitable approach until now. And people have tried to use it for new equals a half, where these states essentially collapse.
So numerically means just trying to diagonalize
the state. Right, because you have fewer states.
Now how do you actually try to do that?
Well, what you do is you essentially expand these operators into a creation annihilation basis. And then you work with creation annihilation operators. So it's like a first quantized approach, in that sense. And then you lose it. It's a finite size calculation, and you have a huge Hilbert space, and there are so many. I think the largest cluster of people have solved is something like 8 particles or something like that.
15.
Hmm?
15.
Now 15?
You can do 15 electrons.
Oh, right. That's huge. So you see, the standards of the field are not great. Of course, people would like to do many more. They'd like to do Monte Carlo, but they have this very famous or infamous sign problem, which here is gets even more difficult because of the magnetic field. There are phases that you have. There are Bohm-Hademann phases that you have to deal with. So you need a more boson if you have a problem. Now, there is a different approach, which requires, to some extent, to use the use of the higher lambda levels and eventually throw them out in the infrared limit. So you can do sort of local physics. It's an approach that is known as flux attachment, and the idea is you take a point particle and you attach an even number of flux quanta to that particle locally at the point in space. There's a simple way to do that, which is to use the John Simons theory to do that, which if you look at the equation of motion, particular Gauss's law in John Simon says that the density is equal to the flux up to a constant, a proportionality constant. So John Simon enters in this theory in a rather essential way when you try to map, say, fermions to fermions by these type of methods. It also appears in another way, which in some sense in my mind is more essential, is through an effective hydrodynamic approach. What I'm going to say now is the end result. You can make this argument based essentially on a number of, essentially very few assumptions, but you can derive these things, particularly for the Jain states. That's something that I have made a living of, at least for a while, to derive these type of things from a more sort of field theoretic point of view. And the argument, and this argument is borrowed from Wen and Zi, is the following. What you have in this problem is a bunch of particles that carry charge, and therefore there should be a conserved current. associated with these particles. Therefore, the divergence, the three divergence of these currents, these in 2 plus 1 dimensions, has to vanish. And that means that you should be able to write the current as the curl of somebody else, because you're in 2 plus 1 dimensions, the somebody else has to be a vector field. Because the only thing that is physical here is the current, it means that gauge transformations of this field are not visible, so you have a gauge theory in reality. So the hydrodynamic picture of a system of charged particles in 2 plus 1 dimensions is a gauge theory. Now, whether the theory is local or not depends on whether or not there is an energy gap in the structure. Okay, so in particular in this case, where the theory is, as we call it, incompressible, which means that there is a large energy gap, we are going to end up with an effective theory which is going to be local. Now, it's important to note that this gauge field has nothing to do with Maxwell's. It's simply a field that is used to manufacture the currents. That's the only thing that you're doing. So let me write down what the effective action is for mu equals 1 over n. For other fractions, it gets more complicated, so let me do the simplest one. So first I'm going to write down the effective action, effective Lagrange, and then I will tell you why this is a good effective Lagrange. It has three terms. The first one involves only the gauge field A. It's a Charles Simons term with a properly quantized coefficient, which here is going to be taken to be an odd integer. Now, we know from Charles Simons' theory it has to be an integer if you're going to put this thing in a torus or in a closed manifold. You cannot have a fraction there. Otherwise, the large gauge transformations are not properly quantized. Okay? So there is a quantization condition that this needs to be arrayed, and from the Pauli principle, if you want to get things that have the proper statistics, you need that to be another integer. You want the term that couples linearly the current to the some external electromagnetic perturbation, not the uniform field, but something used to induce currents. So it's a J.A term, which looks like that. And in addition to that, you may have excitations that will have some finite energy, therefore it will be quasi-static. And if you imagine writing down some kind of Feynman path integral for them, they will look like Wilson loops. So they will look like a set of conserved currents for these quasi-particles that couple linearly to this electromagnetic field. Sorry, to this gauge field. Okay, so these are quasi-static sources, and here I'm plagiarizing Tony right and left. Okay, it's important to note that the Charles Simons theory is a topological field theory. So if I were to, you know, bend my surface and change, if you want, the short distance physics, I will always end up with the same effective theory. So it's independent of the metric in that language. And that means that in a physical sense, if you make small distortions of the system, namely because you have an incompressible fluid, you can make essentially diffeomorphisms, if you want, that do not change the local physics. The only thing that happens is that the boundary gets deformed, but nothing happens in the middle. If you do that sort of adiabatically, otherwise you're going to create local excitations if you pay the energy. Okay, so the key issue here is that you need an effective action that is going to have, it's going to be gauge invariant, and that comes from current conservation. It has to break down reversal symmetry because you started out with a magnetic field, and parity in consequence. And if you, in the spirit, if you want, of an effective theory like a Landau theory, then you should have as smallest possible number of derivatives, which in this case means one. Okay? So the Charles Simons term is the only local action that satisfies all of these properties. So it's a natural candidate. That sense. Has to be properly quantized so that you're going to have the correct degeneracy on a torus, and the degeneracy is n in this particular case. So if you work on a more complicated surface of g would be m to the g. Okay? So that's, if you want, the prediction of this type of theories. You can derive this from a more microscopic approach, but you end up with these answers. Okay, so in particular, if you integrate out this little A gauge field, you can calculate the conductance, and you find that the conductance is indeed mu times this quantity, that is called E square of H, is the quantum of conductance or conductivity in two dimensions, which is the same, and in units where E is 1 and H square is 1, it is mu over 2 pi. which means nu is 1 over 2 pi n. So this is, if you want, the fractional quantum Hall effect is this property.
Can you tell me what transversity
is? Sure. Yes.
Okay.
So there were three terms, right? There is a J dot A term. So if I integrate out this little A gauge field, I can calculate an effective action for the external electromagnetic perturbation and use that to calculate, for instance, the relationship between the field and the current, which will give me the connectivity.
Is this actually supposed to be the same physics as the other, how can you write down with the rho and the b?
Right, that is non-trivial to go from one to the other. If you actually began with a something projected into the lowest lambda level.
Can you explain that to us?
The way we do it is by not projecting. Okay, so what we do is essentially we work with a local field theory, we keep an infinite power of angular momentum states, if you want, of the higher lambda level states. So we work with a local field theory, and then what you do is, because you have an energy gap, it turns out that the contributions that come from these higher order states, they drop off as you go to long distances and low energies. So you end up with this, that's how you derive these effective actions. But if you try to project first, it's very hard to derive this result. In fact, I don't know how to do it. In practice, the only way, the reason we know that the two approaches are equal is because when you do specific calculations of small systems, you can compare the answers and you find the same result.
There's some summer school lectures by Susan Zhang,
which derived.
No,
the only thing he derived, which I did too, he used the Landau-Ginzburg-Chern-Simons theory.
I see.
And I used sort of the fermionic version, which is the same.
Oh, okay.
But to my knowledge, nobody has ever derived this directly from, by projecting first into the lower Landau level. Okay? Now, of course, this is a little different than the kind of things that people in string theory are interested in, where you don't have a finite density of these things. So you're doing perturbation theory, if you want, in a state which already has a mass gap. But if there is a phase transition, as in some, if you take, 5 to the 4th theory, and you work on a non-commutative plane, I think Sondi, for instance, and Gubser found a phase transition there. Interestingly enough, to something that in this language is called a stripe state.
Yes.
It's very similar to that. Then I think there you have to be a bit careful how the things are done, because it's not clear what effect, it's not clear what interpretation is. That's my problem. Okay. Whereas here, in some sense, you are using hydrodynamics, you're using conservation laws. Now, in order to even make sense of hydrodynamics, I need to have the idea of some external electromagnetic perturbation, for instance, or an electric field to probe my system. I understand that in the context of non-commutative field theory, people have tried to put electric fields and found that the theories are not unitary. Now, I'm not sure whether that's a serious problem, or is the old problem of a particle in an electric field having a Hamiltonian that is not bounded from below. In this particular case, because of the presence of the magnetic field, it turns out that it's perfectly well defined. So if you have this radial electric field, as I did, the Hamiltonian is perfectly well defined, it has no problem having a lower bound. Whereas if I didn't have a magnetic field, if I had a uniform electric field that extends over all space, of course I had the same problem.
Right.
That's called electric breakdown, right?
But actually that's velocity, right?
It's determined by that electric field.
It's E
over B. It's E
over B. I don't want E to be bigger than B.
No, so what you do is you need to take the limit carefully.
That's the same thing that you get when you try to put an electric field, magnetic field, on a computer. You can do it.
Yes.
As long as there's an inequality. The limit is sort of light-like when they're sort of equilibrium.
I see.
So people have, in fact, pushed, boosted, if you want.
I see. It's
better, magnetic field. If you boost it, you get an electric field. But you never get something with E bigger than B.
Because one of the invariants is
the
square minus B squared.
Sure, by the usual.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So as long as E is less than B, which is what you have as well,
right,
there's no problem.
There's no parallel thing. So the problem is the opposite limit. Well, the opposite limit, I mean, in practice, even in quantum mechanics, you never take a uniform field over the entire space. I mean, in practice, what you wish you...
It's the same problem.
I mean, they electric field in this region, and then you keep things quiet on the other side, okay? Otherwise, of course, there is no lower bound.
Yeah.
You get electric breakdown, right? Yeah. So, it's not better or worse defined than conventional quantum mechanics in a uniform electric field. I mean, it's not...
No.
So, it's not a pathology of string theory. That's what I'm trying to say, or...
It's not a pathology. String theory, when you do it somehow, you do get...
But it's the same effect, I think. Okay, so let me, come back, let me tell you a little bit about the excitations. But the important issue is that in some sense we made progress in all this year by not going into the lowest lambda level. Unless we wanted to do numerics. And the reason is that essentially we use effective low energy field theories to describe the physics of the systems and stuff.
I guess I don't understand the conflict, because...
it's not a conflict.
I think that the effective lambda level is just throwing away a lot of states that are very high energy.
Correct.
But looking at effective field theories is doing the same thing.
Correct. But the problem is how you formulate it when you do your calculations. If you project first, it turns out you have to... The problem, okay, let me tell you what the problem is in practice. If you work with the Moyard algebra directly, it's an example where you have a simple Hamiltonian with complicated commutation relations. And for instance, a good deal of the problems in high temperature superconductors is the Hamiltonians are extremely simple, and as you observed, the commutation relations are not, because for instance, we have the Heisenberg model is bilinear in the spins. But the spins don't behave like free bosons or anything like that. They are not canonical, right? So having a simple Hamiltonian with complicated commutation relations sometimes is more of a problem than an advantage. So what people end up doing in these things is they make approximations in the commutation relations, which change the physics. On the other hand, if you want to keep the magnetic algebra, you say the magnetic algebra is really what matters, you can do that with the local field theory by restoring all of these lambda levels, and they take the low energy limit. That way you don't violate anything. So you keep the algebra intact, you keep the symmetry
just
correct.
People haven't developed methods for working.
Correct. Correct. And the methods that people have are just too clumsy in the mind. And they are uncontrolled. Okay. Simply because the algebra one doesn't know what representation this algebra has. In the same way, there are things for which we understand the representation theory quite well. Here we don't.
Say, which algebra?
The Moyard algebra.
The algebra of the densities.
Right, the algebra of the it's essentially the algebra of the magnetic translations.
That's
simple. But when you go to the... You can think of the algebra of the densities as a generalized magnetic algebra. Yeah.
It's the same question I asked a few minutes ago, but it's
yes.
I'm just trying to try to just follow up. So before you said rho of x, v of x minus y, rho of y.
Right.
You might get that. Was that algebra? Was that, you worked on the conical domain, was it just the product?
I think I'm
reading
the same question.
You want to see a little star? Is that what the problem is? Okay, there is a way in which you will see the stars and all of that if you write it. If you write these operators in terms of coherent states.
The point is not to write.
At the moment, this is just a product, okay?
Yeah.
It's a product.
So
it's a conventional product
for
product.
The momentum wise. So you see, the world is like when you scale up your momentum, this is the way you're doing it.
Right.
The way scale is going.
Yeah.
So if I were to take that Hamiltonian,
yes.
I should be able to write it as just. Because
rho
by phi scale
of
it should be okay.
It's the same. So you just do it, you expand in Fourier modes.
So that's exactly phi star v of x plus, so you do star product for x and y. So it's V of, V, rho of, so it's a phi of x star, V star, phi of y. So it's just non-local.
Let me make it simple. Suppose you go to a first quantized version, so you have n particles only, so these densities are just delta functions in that case. Okay? So what you have is a sum.
Can I make a comment that may help Aki, because I've been discussing some of this with Aki? Is that if you derive equation motion for rho dot, then you can commute rho to h, and then the star product would appear, right? I showed you the equation motion.
So is that what the question is about, this, where the star product appears, or?
Well, you sort of see it in a form that looks like the kind of...
Let me tell you, there is a way in which you can do that. You can write this in terms, if you use a set of coherent states, for which, in fact, I wasn't planning to talk about this, but let me just make a quick comment. So you can define a set of coherent states, which is as close as you can define in this in a system like in the problem with lambda level, as to define a local particle. Of course, these coherent states have overlaps that look like this, okay, up to the factors of a magnetic length, and so on. If you expand, you write these objects in terms of coherent states, then it turns out that there is a representative of this algebra in that language that this actually has the star product explicitly in that. That's, for instance, how there are some recent papers by Pasquier in particular, where he works out some soliton states that appear in some cases, and they are written down exactly in that language.
When you write rules next, that rule is an operator, right?
Yeah.
And that's just a coherent state sandwich.
But if you want, in the moment it's written not in terms of coherent state, but if you want to do it in that fashion,
it's a function of x.
Correct.
And the x refers to position.
Correct.
So that's mostly a coherent state center.
Correct.
Right? So rho is like x, 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 x.
Yeah.
So that's what we would write as a locative scalar field at position x.
Correct.
There's no processing is needed to think of that as a star product, right? It just, phi of x
this
star,
is, yeah. Okay.
X
sorry.
Star on the x of the x minus y.
Yeah. So I'm not actually trying to write y as x plus displacement, and each bit of displacement just to make like these. Then it's the same star, right?
Well, you write that as either the IP, px, py, or q square.
So just a generator of finite translations.
What's
up?
It just works for
but this is an example that it's not the even the IPX which are based this algebra, but the whole row, it's not the occurrence which look
correct.
It becomes, if you write it in
relation for row times row.
So it looks like one piece.
Now, would it be one piece? Is that an equation? Is this? Is rho of p times rho of q equal to rho of p plus q times the phase?
Yeah,
look at this.
Yes.
That's it.
I don't know, but so that taking the difference of two of those things, less information.
Yes.
Oh, no, yes, you can do it in the other way too.
No,
right, sure.
The other way is more information.
Okay, that's simply the magnetic translations. We'll give you
so, but the real thing is rho of p times rho of q.
Q is rho of p plus q times the phase factor. Correct. Absolutely. Right.
And perhaps
that's where that comes from.
Perhaps I may make another comment, which is that you mentioned that some people try to simplify the algebra.
Yeah.
So for instance, but it's very difficult because recently Gurari and I tried to replace the sine function on the right by a linear function.
Yes.
And then we discovered we can lose some of the essential
functions. Right. And this is the problem in for new equals a half, for instance, Shankar has been doing a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he does is precisely that linearization.
The Steve Shankar?
No, Shankar, not Shankar. Shankar. This is a Shankar theory.
It seems to be very interesting.
It is a dangerous thing to do, and, okay. So I'm not going to make more comments. I think people have gone around in circles. That's my view.
It's not in a circle in the real life.
Right. Yeah, that's the spherical. So this is the spherical cover approximation. No, but I think that changes the physics. Okay.
The theory is just non-commutative scalar theory with no kinetic term, with no local interaction in addition to non-commutivity. E is like one of our.
Yeah, whatever, it doesn't matter really.
It is nostalgia, right? Why is it nostalgia?
Nostalgia was either the IP dot X, or the IP dot Q equals the sum for every exponential function. Look at this, this is for every function.
For every function.
That, this is for the...
No, Q is not a momentum.
No, but if you...
It's a momentum, that's not a prime way.
It's not about, let's call it all P to the IP X.
Then it is.
When he writes rule of X, I assume he fully transformed, right?
Yeah, this is a free transfer
so
for
X. It's exactly like, so if rule of P is equal to IPX, then it's exactly the rule of X. So it's just to
say there was a reason why we don't try to know it's
IPX. Okay, so you still say that that's not just phi of X star V of X minus Y star phi of Y?
I didn't get that.
Yeah.
So could you say the X is
commutative? Yeah. Can I go on? Then we discuss it? Otherwise,
okay, sorry.
What is the point?
We're a little confused as to what this...
What is computation related to?
Look, what you do is
very simple. You simply say, you write this in first quantization, so you write the density operator as a sum of delta functions, and if you want to Fourier space, the delta functions become exponential. Right? So they are into the IP dot X. But X and Y don't commute because you're in this lowest lambda level, you're in the magnetic plane. Okay? And then you derive the algebra from it.
Therefore it seems that looks like you have phi of X star V of X minus Y star phi of Y, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it is true.
So the statement is that you have a norm. If I have phi star phi, that'll be a trivial theory. And the only reason why it's not trivial is because you have phi star V star phi and V is furthermore local.
Right, and that gives you some...
But it doesn't have a kinetic term, so in that sense it's trivial from... It just, all that trivial is in the local.
Okay, the reason what makes it non-trivial is the fact that it's a definite density. If this was at zero density, then it's trivial. Just simply take a pair of particles, you can write down a few bound states and stuff like that.
I can't think of fire as a linear scalar field, forget about whether it's a density.
But this would be like a problem in which, suppose you have a complex scalar field, on a non-commutative space, and I impose the condition that you're not working in the vacuum, but you work at some finite density, so some finite charge, or that you
Okay, so that's not visible in the, just looking at...
Yeah, because I work in the case, I am saying I'm going to work at fixed field factors, so it means that there's a total number of particles. So whereas... Correct, it's equal to that. So in general, in the field theory, that will break...
So with the constraint and that, then it's equivalent to the topological...
Correct. Okay, so this doesn't have a feature of relativistic field theories on non-commutative plane, which is that it doesn't have charge conjugation symmetry. On the other hand, if you go to the middle of the lambda level, there is an effect, there is an extra discrete symmetry that behaves exactly the same way if you take the infinite volume limit. So you recover a version, if you want, an analog of that, and this language is called particle Hall symmetry for good reason. Okay, so it has some of the same ingredients. Okay, in fact, that's what I wanted to comment. Things getting long.
This can't be solved for anything but very special potentials.
Correct. And only for one state. You never know the full spectrum. What you know is the ground state, and then you can make variation arguments about the different excited state. But you hit that with the density operator, for instance, and things like that. Okay, now. This Lagrangian is holographic in the conventional sense that you guys use, in the sense that the only excitations at low energy, namely the massless excitations that you have, reside precisely at the physical edge created, in this case, by the electric field. So, in fact, what you have there is a chiral conformal field theory at that boundary. So even though you started with a theory that looked, rather complicated in that sense, you actually achieved some simplicity at the edge of this theory. And the only simple way to actually, well, there are two ways to see it. One from finite size calculations, I do see the spectrum having an edge mode with the right properties. But the only simple way to do it that I know of is to begin with this effective theory. And then you go through the conventional quantization of John Simons on the disk, and you find that in fact it's a conformal field theory at the edge, which is higher. It has a compactification radius, and that's an important issue, which is inherited from the quantum Hall physics that tells you what operators you're allowed to write down in the book to begin with. Okay? So it's not an uncompactified field has a compactification radius, which is the square root of the film factor. Okay. And that means, so it means that you have, essentially comes from the requirement that if you're going to write down an operator that creates an electron, it has to be single value as you go around the system. Okay, so that condition. For, if you have a, for a field under level, essentially, compactification radius is 1. Free formula. It's a free formula. But for any other case, it's something else, okay? It's in one of these other summings. So for instance, you can write down the electron operator, and you can calculate its proper boundary, and it looks like this, 1 over z minus z prime to the power n, which is precisely this integer. And you see that the fact that this integer is odd is important, because for this to be a fermion, it has to be odd and there is change. It is also single-valued, there has no branch cards in it, but it doesn't look like a conventional free fermion. In other words, it doesn't have a pole, it has a high order pole, as you can see. It doesn't have an isolated pole. On the other hand, there is another excitation that is known as the quasi-particle that physically comes from this idea that was introduced by Laughlin of introducing a fluxoid, if you want, a quantum of flux in the middle of the sample. Because of incompressibility, you expel some charge to the boundary. The amount of charge happens to be equal to 1 over m, and the propagator, in other words, is an operator you can derive that creates those states. The propagator that you find is that. Notice this interesting duality. In fact, this is related by a t-duality, as it happens. And this guy has a branch cut, and therefore is the object that carries fractional charge and fractional statistics, and they are related by these sort of dualities.
Well, okay? Boundary states, right? So, in what sense is there a one-to-one mapping to?
In the sense that for every state in the bulk that you can create, that has this, there is a, if you will, a conformal power whose primary operator is this thing.
Okay.
Okay.
And that's just because you can't essentially create states in the bulk that all the same.
Well, because it's states? Correct. Because all states in the bulk are very extensive. Essentially, you have Sandy gap to infinity in the bulk. When I wrote it.
So the only states are.
Right. So what you create at the boundary essentially are things created by this operator plus oscillator modes. That's all there is.
You can probably say that it creates an excitation of the bulk, which has a gap. And you take it close to the boundary, it creates an excitation of the boundary, which is gapless.
So there's
one-to-one correspondence
to something. Yeah, but it's a correspondence between to the primary fields that create the conformal power. Right, in that sense. So in that sense, it's similar to this ABS type correspondences. It's very much in the same spirit. But of course, this is something that we knew.
It's like a topological theory.
Well, right, but that's the reason. But that's why that happens, okay?
Is it ABS, you don't have topological.
Well, I don't know. I once asked Juan Mangasena why he thought this was happening. So because it's a theory of gravity and integrate over all metrics. Yeah, I'm not sure about this. I know. Yeah, no, and there are things, right, which here they don't exist. You've got that, you've got that again. So in that sense, it's a profound difference, but it has the same feature. Sure, absolutely. Because it has no local low energy excitations. That's how you made it topological, right? Well, but it could have been empty. Most theories of that type essentially have a ground state and nothing else. This theory has, well, no, if you close, then you have a large gauge transformation for the wrong thing. Yeah. So, and the other operator that will be important with photos, of course, is the current of the boundary, which is just a derivative of this field. Now, let me comment about a number of open problems which are related to this issue of the dipoles that you guys are interested in. And I was writing more transparencies when David called me home. So it's good that I didn't get to that one more. Okay, so let me list a number of interesting problems that are not fully understood. What is the problem of what happens, say, if you go to the middle of a lambda level? It turns out that these families of states that I wrote here, the kind of filling factor p over 2np plus minus 1, so if n is 1, you end up, as I said, as p goes to infinity, you know, to that, it turns out that the energy gaps that you calculate when you do retail calculations are seen to become progressively smaller. Okay?
What do you mean, do you calculate?
When you do, say you take a field theory, you do mean field calculations, plus corrections, all kinds of things.
Correction time?
Yeah. So in the process of arriving at effective theory, you can get estimates what the gaps look like. They are not infinite, they are finite. And it turns out that there is a hierarchy of gaps, and for instance, states that are higher up in this hierarchy have smaller gaps than states which are lower in the hierarchy. So as you increase P, the gaps get smaller and smaller, and as you go to the accumulation point, the gaps collapsed. Now, notice that in the way people derive these things, you have to go to the local limit, because you have to attach fluxes to particles at the point, and therefore you need all of the states in all the Landau levels to do that. You can only work in one Landau level alone. Okay? Now, if you take the long distance limit, you get rid of that problem of Landau level mixing, as people call it. But that works because you have a mass gap. And so at low energies, most of that goes away. But if the gap collapses, you never recover from it. Okay? So at low equals a half, it's one of the examples where these calculations go bad. And what you find is that the corrections to these sort of mean field calculations are infrared divergent. In fact, they look like Fermi-liquid-like states coupled to gauge fields. And the gauge fields induce infrared divergences, for instance, the effective masses of the particles and things of that sort. And they are not totally different from similar problems that appear in the sort of gauge theory approach to high VC. They are very similar in character. And they have the same illness, and that's why it's an interesting problem. Okay. So, people are not, I mean, they went through different approaches. The most recent incarnation of this problem involved precisely projecting to the lowest Landau level, and this is a list of characters, and I forgot Shankar, who actually did a lot of work on this. I should have his name here. There is an analog of this problem if you have hardcore bosons at no equals one. It turns out that they have the same problem. They also have the same type of difficulty. It turns out that for both of these systems, it turns out that you can write. But the point is that because they are bosons, you know, bosons like to stay close. I mean, you can both condense because you assume they have a hard core. But because it's bosons, the physics is different. Okay. So in fact, bosons at no equals one behave similarly to electrons at no equals a half. We have a Coulomb interaction. Well, essentially it comes from Compton, and the pair interaction doesn't really matter. It's in a magnetic field. But the point is that this has...
You
need more of that. You need some short-range interaction. Okay. One of the other will do, but it doesn't matter what the interaction is, but it has to be more than local. For bosons, you need a condition that there is a hard core because you don't want both condensation. Otherwise, it would be some other superfluid state. Now, it turns out, in particular here, one of the things that can happen when you have essentially a Fermi C, which is what this effective series look like, is that you may end up getting instability to, say, a pair state, something that may look like superconductivity. And it turns out that you can write down a state that goes on the realm of a Fuffian state, which is a candidate state for no equals a half. It's a rather interesting disk. And it has a wave function in the lowest Landau level that looks like a Fuffian times a product of the type that I wrote before. It's an even integer now because what makes it odd is this. And this is essentially an anti-symmetric, it's a sum of all anti-symmetric pairs that you can write down of this type. Okay, it has an interesting interpretation in terms of conformal field theory. It turns out to be the isomorph. It's a factor there of a theory at c equals a half. And if you derive the effective theory of the edge, there has c equals 3/2 in this particular state. So in practice, many of us believe that the problem with these states is that these states are unstable, and you really, the ground state is that, is something else. Okay. But maybe the difficulty with the states is that they're actually truly unstable, that infrared divergence is not an artifact of the calculation. It's a signature that is a wrong ground state, and the right ground state is something more like that, which has a gap. Okay. And
experimentally
seen at 5/2. not a, a dry hive has never been seen, but the five hives in the gap is...
Five hives, there's no gap.
A five hives, what they see is a gap state, which is forbidden by all the rules except for this type of states. So you fill up essentially one lambda level with up and down electrons, and you go to the middle of the next lambda level, the first one, and that's actually, it turns out to be a good candidate for that. This state is interesting in other ways. It has excitations that have a fractional charge, and they have non-Abelian statistics. In other words, they have manoeuvrable matrices, which are non-trivial. So if you go around, you have three of these particles, they know that the other two are present. So they are more complicated beasts in that sense. Okay?
The Fafian state.
There is a simpler version of that. It is a so-called, I'm going to come to that as an example, is a so-called Abelian 331 state, which I will show you in a moment, because it's a state where you will see these dipoles coming out in a very clear fashion. Okay? And it turns out that some of these striped states, they also appear near the middle of the lambda level, so they're all competing with each other. So let me talk a little bit about this state, and you will see what the role of these dipoles is. This is a state that appears in the following context. There are systems where they can make two versions of the two-dimensional electron gas, which is what people call a bilayer. Okay, so there are two layers of electrons. And you tune the density in such a way that this layer is half-filled and that layer is half-filled. Okay. Sorry, this layer is quarter-filled, and this quarter-filled, you know, the total mu is one-half. This is wrong. I'm sorry about that. The total mu is one-half. It's a wave function for a state that has strong Coulomb interactions, not only inside each layer but across, but has no tunneling, that was proposed by Halpern long ago. It's a generalization of the Laughlin state, so it has this in the same plane carrying a power of 3, this in the values in the other plane with 3 also, but there is a cross interaction, essentially it's trying to repel particles from one plane to be close to the other, and it comes with the first power. You can write down an effective gauge theory for this, the same, along the same lines. There are two fields. Let me tell you what it looks like. So if instead of 3 and 1, I have M, M, and M, some people call it the M and M states, okay? And it turns out that there are two currents that you can write, so it's a symmetric and an anti-symmetric, and we come with two coefficients, M plus M and M minus M. When you go to the edge, you get two bosons with two different compactification values. So this will be the charge field, and this is the relative, or sometimes called the neutral mode, the neutral field. So there are two kind of bosons now with different compactification radii. The particular case of 331, it turns out that the neutral field has compactification radius equals to 1 over the square root of 2, which is the famous SC2 radius. Okay, and the other thing is that that's where these dipoles show up in a natural way, and that's precisely because the system is half-filled. Once again, it's a dynamical symmetry that appears. So if you look at the charge fields, because of these guys, they satisfy, you have an enhanced symmetry, it looks like an SU2 symmetry. In the neutral sector, you can have a Dirac fermion that you can write down. That comes from, put all these things together. It turns out that there is a charge, the fundamental excitation has charge 1/4, this has charge 1/2. It's something which is even smaller than it has charge 1/4, and in some sense you need vertex operators from both fields to construct it. But you can show that this object here, the current associated with the charge field, is essentially coming from the OPE of two of these guys. Okay, because it's neutral. And so you can think of that current, which is a neutral operator, as being created, being consisting of a dipole, if you want, of two quasi-particles, which are coupled to each other, forming, you know, making up a neutral object, if you want. Now, this is a diagonal generator, effectively, which is a diagonal generator of this SU2, and here it appears as naturally. So there are a number of cases like this, where the effective theory, if you want, contains some fundamental excitation that has some funny charge, if you want, and some funny statistics. In the Fafian, there is an analog of that, that is this object that has non-Abelian statistics, but the OPEs of those generate this object that have this sort of dipole structure, and that's why they end up looking like a derivative, okay, or that it looks like in that language. So for these states that end up being topological once again, it turns out that we understand what these dipoles do. Now it turns out that there is a formulation of these other programs where we are not sure exactly how they behave, but you can actually write it down in terms of the theory of dipoles. Now what is the result of that, we don't quite know yet. And that's what I thought was interesting when I saw you guys interested in dipoles, because maybe this is part, maybe you guys have some ideas that will help us with these other problems. On the other hand, my gut feeling is that the system manages itself to end up in states like those, or like the one I showed you here, and therefore you end up with a topological theory once again with a gap in the spectrum and one-to-one correspondence and all of that. And all things considered, if the system has the possibility of having a gap, it will have a gap. Right? It's a lot lowering the energy. So that's probably what happens here. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.